Okay, let me brief. Now's our final panel where we're going to actually talk on the subject of book banning. And I just want to thank everybody, and I'm sure we're in for a very informative and interesting talk. The format is going to be that Dr. Shapiro will speak first, and I'll mention those who weren't here earlier, his new book on the limits of Orthodox theology, Maimonides and the 13 Principles of Faith, was available on Amazon.com, but it'll actually be printed on Monday. This is hot off the press before the press. So you can order it, but it'll be available next week. This is actually an expansion of an article that he wrote a number of years ago, a fascinating article in Torah Mother Journal. That's now a much enlarged book. So he'll speak on the whole issue of book banning that has been going on in the world outside a number of books written by Orthodox people having put under the ban, as we would say. And then Dr. Lyman is going to talk a little bit on an issue of the making of the Gadol, which of course was the book that got a lot of play for the recent ban that was put out. And without further ado, I'm going to let our two wonderful speakers and great scholars take over. Thank you.
What time should I stop?
Don't go for 40, 45
okay.
minutes.
Before I begin, I just want to say this is really Hashgacha Pratis, because I come from Scranton, University of Scranton, and in another 2 months we're having an exhibition on the 150 years of Jewish life in Scranton. And my job is to speak about the three most important figures in Jewish life in Scranton. One, Harry Wolfson. I could speak about him very well. I'm a Talmud of a Talmud, the greatest scholar of Jewish philosophy in the 20th century. I also can speak very well on Zev Gold, the founder of the Mizrahi movement, the founder of Torah Vadas, incidentally, and the Vadas, Torah and Wisdom, is forgotten today. But I also wanted to speak about the third most important individual, which we heard it mentioned, but he didn't mention Scranton, Rabbi Shraga Feivel Mendelovich, who actually began his American career, a significant American career, in Scranton. And I didn't feel till today that I could speak properly on him, because I do have the biographies. And I had heard that he was a fan of Rav Kook. He has a student in McKeesport who told me that. But I looked and I didn't find anything. And now I feel I can give a more complete overview when I speak to the community, and I'll be b'shem his grandson. So very fortunate I was able to be here. Thank you. And again, just one for those who I began speaking, there was a lot of snow, very few people here. So let me take the opportunity again to tell you how wonderful it is to be here, and that what's going on, this programming, you know, to do one of these once a year is significant, to constantly... We could use this in New York City. I mean, this is really something. You should feel very thrilled that you have as Professor Tversky, one of his favorite words, indefatigable efforts of Rabbi Kelman and Elliot and the rest. Okay. At the end of 2002, within the space of a few months, Orthodox Jewry witnessed something very unusual. With great publicity, two books were placed under a ban. Actually, there was a few others, but... two important books were placed under a ban. Nathan Kamenetsky's Making of a Gadol and Jonathan Sacks's Dignity of Difference. Kamenetsky is the son of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, died in 1986, one of the Gadolim of a previous generation, and is himself a personality in the Haredi world, having been one of the founders of the Itri Yeshiva. In years past, he was even worthy of being referred to as Hagaon by Yated Naaman. Jonathan Sacks is the chief rabbi of England, technically the chief rabbi of the United Hebrew Congregations of Britain, and he is an eloquent spokesman for traditional Judaism, as well as a most prolific author. Although there was a time when bans were issued against the writings of various heretics, today the boundaries are clear. If you're going to be writing bans against every work of a heretic, you'd be doing this constantly. You don't need to write bans anymore against the works of Reform rabbis and others, because the Orthodox community knows that they don't need not to go near these works. In fact, in modern times, scholars in the Haredi world will only rarely see the need to issue bans. And we'll talk about that in a minute. And when they come, they are directed usually against distinguished individuals who identify with Orthodoxy, because it's only those individuals whom the Hamon Am, especially in the ultra-Orthodox world, might look at them and say, he's a big rabbi, maybe I should read his book. So they must be told not to look at his book. There are exceptions, for example, the banning of Mordechai Kaplan's prayer book in 1945, although this is exceptional, since the very concept of a prayer book, when you don't believe in God, is something that the rabbis had to respond to. Also, if you read in Hapardes and others, they tell you that he was teaching at Jewish Theological Seminary. I mean, this was a man who was in, to a certain extent, in the organized Jewish community, and they felt they needed to respond to something which, and they make it clear that usually, they say, usually we wouldn't even bother responding to this, but since other people haven't said anything, we need to speak. Thus, there is no need for a condemnation of a book written by a typical modern Orthodox intellectual. I'll put a stress on modern, because maybe I'll put ultra, and I mentioned Dr. Lyman, that he has contacts in a lot of these communities. If I really want to increase sales, I think you should speak to some of your friends and put my book in the fair realm. But there's no need to put bans against me. Okay. I have kids I need to put through day school too. On the other hand, if you're dealing with a figure like the Rav, or Joseph E. Soloveitchik, there is indeed a possibility that he could have an influence in the Haredi world. As such, it is no surprise that Rav Shach, who was at the time the leading ideologue of Das Torah in the Haredi world, when asked about the Rav's views of Zionism as expounded in his classic Chamesh Drashot, Rav Shach replied that his view departed from Das Torah. I mean, not the Rav, I guess, can have his own Das Torah, but when you say Das Torah, you mean Das Torah in the yeshiva world. And as such, his work was forbidden to be read because it contained heresy, pure and simple. Rav Shach's words is Mamash Divrei Kefira. As the guardian of Haredi Orthodoxy, it was Rav Shach's role to establish the boundary line between Haredi Orthodoxy and other forms of Orthodoxy, and he did it with a stridency that many will find disconcerting. Among the other institutions he issued condemnations of include Torah College, the Jerusalem College of Technology, Michala, the Marava School, Heichal Shlomo, the Hezder Movement, the Steinsaltz Talmud, Steinsaltz himself is actually called a heretic, other books by this author, Yehuda Levy's book, Shari Talmud Torah, which I believe has Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's Haskama on, and supports the Torim Derech Eretz perspective, and others. Since these institutions and books were clearly part of the Orthodox world, and are even supported by great scholars, it was necessary for them to be condemned, lest the Haredi public be led astray. Of course, all this is not new. Bans go back. I spoke about the Rambam this morning. His books were placed under the ban. Books of Hasidic leaders, historical works, the Moray Naim. Naftali Hertz Weisel's book was placed under Chayr. In fact, this early Maskil, there's a rabbi in Israel, Moshe Tsuriel, some of you might know from Michala, he now has been reissuing the works of Weisel, because, and he quotes many Gedolim who thought Naftali Hertz Weisel was a kosher Maskil, and you can learn a lot from his works. I had a correspondence with him. I mean, I know him a bit. Story goes, this isn't his first run-in with the authorities. I don't know if it's true. I never asked him. When I was in yeshiva, we all spoke about the fact that this early edition of his book, Beis Yisrael, spoke about a kippah seruga as being a hidur mitzvah, and they forced him to remove that. Here's just a copy of his letter to me. He wrote to me after I wrote to him inquiring. I sent him some new sources on Weisel, and he writes back, he's American, from near Israel, but he's been in Israel for many years. I am happy that I find in you a comrade spirit. Freedom of thought is the oxygen of humanity. 2! We must dispel the fog of tyrannical thought despots. Writings of the Kabbalistic writings that were put under Chayim, anti-Kabbalistic writings. It's a long history. The writings of Rav Kiva Yosef Schlesinger and the writings of Rav Kook. Chayims have a long history. Concerning the more recent examples of Rav Shach's condemnations, since he was only regarded as a leader in the Haredi world, his pronouncements were not given much concern in the wider Orthodox world. In fact, I think it's a testament to the wider Orthodox world's respect for his great Torah scholarship that he wasn't condemned, and that people in the modern section and others, the religious Zionist section, really didn't condemn him. It's known that Rav Yehuda Kook and others would tell their students not to condemn him. And that's a testament to his great Torah scholarship. And you don't find it going in the other direction. In the Haredi world, it's much more difficult to find respect for Gedolim in other camps. I mean, this is nothing new. People who often will send their kids to a modern Orthodox day school and they'll give money to Haredi institutions, but it doesn't go the other way. People in the Haredi world won't support the modern Orthodox world. We are their institutions. It's always easy to have more respect for people on your right. But when it comes to Haredi attitudes towards modern Orthodox and religious Zionism, it's more complicated because you do sometimes find elements of respect, but it's always coupled with signs that there are problems. For example, think of the Jewish Observer's so-called eulogy for Rav Soloveitchik. It wasn't even mentioned in the title page. And they're very careful at how they phrase it. In fact, the literature that disrespects Torah scholars is a staple in the Haredi world. But of course, these Torah scholars are always found in a different ideological camp. Usually the disrespect is seen in the way that they are referred to. And this goes on literally every week. If Yatei Neman, recently they attacked Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz. I think they referred to him as an Orthodox rabbi in quotes. And they consistently will attack. But it usually doesn't get that bad. Usually what you'll find, anyone who reads Hebrew Haredi literature knows, it'll be Harav Hagon. But when they refer to the Rav Kook or Rav Herzog, it's just Harav. and you know when the Gaon is left off. Why? No one can doubt their Torah scholarship, but they don't follow Das Torah. Because of this pattern, it was somewhat of a surprise when people first heard about Kamenetsky's making of a Gadol, because this comes from the Haredi world. And the story, he's the son of the Gadol. This is before people had seen the book. The story quickly spread, accompanied by all sorts of rumors, eventually became a focus of a New York Times article. In the handout there, I have a picture of Kamenetsky from the New York Times article. When the official Cherem finally appeared with Revel Yashev's name at the top of the signatories, the book became an immediate collector's item. Most Sfarim stores wouldn't even carry it. It sold at auction, Rabbi Kamenetsky told me a few weeks ago, for $1,400. It is now kept in the restricted collections of the great Jewish libraries. I got it just by accident. I ordered it from my university library when Beagle Eisen and Borough Park told me about this. When I saw that on the front page of the book, he had plagiarized, he had taken my picture of the Tzedakah of Weinberg, I said, this is interesting, you know. But then I opened it, and I immediately asked a friend who has contacts in this world, are they going to let him get away with this, or will his Zechus Avos save him? But I decided to keep the book, and I'm happy I have it, because now I couldn't have been able to get it. You can see it in the restricted sections. I called Tuvia's in Muncie. It's a big Jewish bookstore there, because I had heard they had copies, and I wanted some more copies, so you can make a lot of money selling them, or arbitrage. And I knew he had them, because I knew someone who got it from there. And in the space of one conversation, I called him on a Sunday. The owner told me first he did not have any copies. And a few minutes later, he said he had them, but tomorrow they're going to make a bonfire and burn them all. And by the end of the conversation, he said, if I brought a letter from an important Rav saying that I had permission to read the book, he would give it to me. And yet, having said that, there was a group of guys from YU who had bought it privately and was kept under the table, and they went up and they actually got the books. He was afraid, apparently. Now, before even discussing the book itself briefly, and then move on to the Sachs book, a word must be said about the figure of Rav Yosef Shlomo Yashiv, who in the last 10 years has become the supreme authority in the Haredi world, the final word in all matters of importance. Rav Yosef actually stands as clear evidence that this institution of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah is a fiction. This idea that the Aguda is supposed to have this group of rabbis who are supposed to decide questions. The fact is, and this has been documented by a Haredi historian, Zvi Weinman, who actually writes real history, it has always been, from the beginning, that although you have this fiction of a Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, there's always been one Gadol who makes the decision, and everyone else falls in line. It could be Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, it could have been the Chazon Ish, and today it's Rav Yosef. Bottom line is, he makes the decision, and they're not going to get together and have a group and outvote him. That's not the way it works. However, unlike Rav Shach, whose role Rav Yosef assumed, most of Rav Yosef's life did not follow the typical Haredi pattern. He is the grandson of Shlomo Yashiv, famed Kabbalist, author of important Kabbalistic work, and a close friend of Rav Kook. He is the son-in-law of Rav Arye Levine. You've all seen the book at Tzaddik in Our Time, which shows, mentioned love affairs, the love affair of Rav Arye Levine with Rav Kook. You can't get a closer connection. Rav Yashiv himself served for many years as a dayan in the Israeli chief rabbinate. To this day, he lives on a pension from the Israeli government. It was only when Rav Shlomo Goren was elected chief rabbi in 1972 that Rav Yosef, who was then serving on the Supreme Beis Din, resigned because he felt that he could not coexist with Rav Goren's halachic approach. He felt it was a threat to the halachic system. In retrospect, this was a very significant step, for only by breaking his ties to the official rabbinate would he be able to emerge 20 years later as the supreme leader of the Haredi. In Rav Shach and Rav Seipor's letters, they say that you can't be a government dayan. They don't want their followers. And yet Rav Yosef was part of that. He was very close to Rav Herzog and Rav Unterman. Because Rav Yosef has not always been part of the Haredi world and is not engaged in sharp attacks on other segments of Orthodoxy, at least until recently, he remained well-respected in the religious Zionist community even when he began to publicly identify with Haredi ideology. When I was in yeshiva in Israel, one of my rabbis was a man by the name of Steiner. He's a big sofer from Merkaz Harav. He would go to Rav Yosef to ask him shaylos. I don't think they would do it today, but many people in the religious Zionist world would go to him, even though they knew he wasn't a Zionist, but he was an important gadol. As such, his views on various communal issues should certainly be taken seriously, I would say, even if not ultimately accepted by all members of the Orthodox world. Having offered this background, let me now speak a bit about what was problematic about making of a gadol that forced this great sage and others to issue condemnations. And I have copies of the Cherems, including one, I won't translate it, but if you know Hebrew, it's scatological. It was placed on the Asharim in the packet there. The book is titled A Study of Episodes in the Lives of Great Torah Personalities, and it's an apt description. It's 1,398 pages. he uses the biography of his father to discuss many gedolim in the yeshiva world, focusing on the late 19th and 20th century. It's not an easy book to read. It's been organized terribly. He could have used a good editor. Here's a perfect example of where a secular education would have come in handy, because he has great information. There's no question he's a master of information, a terrible organization. There are actually 21 pictures of gedolim on the front and back book jackets, although unfortunately none of them are identified, and the average reader will not realize that one of the pictures is of a very youthful and stylishly dressed Rav Aaron Cutler. In addition, there's a picture here of Rav Soloveitchik, upper right-hand corner at the top, together with Rav Aaron Cutler, showing that Nathan Kamenetsky's view of who is a gadol is wider than that of the Haredi world. He is actually the son-in-law of Rav David Lifshitz, who taught for many years at YU. And subsequent to my writing about this, I discovered in the YU archives a copy of the diary of Yaakov Kamenetsky, in which Rav Yaakov tells a story about when he was asked by Belkin to go to YU, he didn't go, and he says he should have gone. He would have had more of an influence, but he didn't know what he could tell his sons, because they were going to Lakewood and other places, and yet he says he would have had more of an impact had he taught at YU. I published what I'm telling you today. I published, and at the time, unfortunately, I hadn't yet found this copy in Rav Yaakov's own handwriting. It's part of a letter to Rav Nosson Kamenetsky describing this meeting with Belkin. In the foreword to the book, Kamenetsky discusses two ways history has been written in the Orthodox community: the hagiographic approach, I guess the art score approach, and the realistic approach, and he tells us that he intends to write real history. While portraying gedolim as the outstanding figures they were, he writes that, quote, "If a minor blemish, and on a truly great man it is never more than minor, also exists, it does not ruin the grace of the outstanding personality." By calling attention to imperfections, he does not believe that he is diminishing the gedolim this way. And here, of course, is the problem in the eyes of the Haredi world. While most of them would admit that even gedolim have faults, it is regarded as improper for these faults to be pointed out. And let me just say straight ahead. There is elements of disrespect in this book to gedolim. Even I think that. That doesn't mean it's not true. But so there are problematic elements from that perspective. Disrespect, if you believe that calling attention to an imperfection is disrespect. Now, it's true that the stories recorded by Kamenetsky have always been part of an oral tradition. Anyone who spent time in yeshiva has heard these stories and stories like them. They're told and retold, but to see them in print, I also admit, is a little jarring. And that's what brought out the fury of the gedolim. They stated as follows, quote, this is the text of the Cherem: "We were appalled to hear from reliable Talmidei Chachamim about the distribution and sale of a book called Making of a Gadol, which is full of severely debasing remarks, derisiveness, degradation, and otzah shemra against several figures among Gedolei HaRabbanim." And it goes on, that he talked about how he disgraced them, and that one cannot keep this book in your house. The book also is condemned for it, quote, "damages the proper hashgafah." Why? Because it blends external studies together with the pure study of the Holy Torah. And here I must confess, I don't know what the band is talking about, because nowhere in Kamenetsky's book does he advocate some sort of Torim Derech Eretz approach in opposition to the yeshiva world. I would assume that a few references to his father as being aware of modern Hebrew and Russian literature, as well as having some awareness of Aristotle, Plato, and Kant, is not so terrible as to bring about such a strong denunciation, or the fact that he mentions that Rav Aaron Cutler also had some secular knowledge. Neither is the report that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky recommended to the principal of the secular department of Torah Vadas that the students study, as part of their English curriculum, certain Shakespeare plays, quote, "because in olden times there was less reference to topics in which yeshiva bachrim should not be exposed to." Now, I could be wrong about this. It's possible that we have reached the point where Haredi society now feels that gedolim should have absolutely no knowledge of anything other than Torah. Yet it's also possible that the signers of the Cherem, none of who read English, were misinformed about the real content of the book. Someone told them that he speaks in favor of changing the structure of yeshivas. And I should note that in the Cherem signed by the American Rosh Yeshiva, which is also in the packet, they don't mention anything about secular studies. Incidentally, Rav Shach's wife went to university in Moscow. Rav Aaron Cutler's daughter was a graduate student of political science at Columbia. I think she might have even finished. She was also a delegate to the Democratic National Convention. Today no Beis Yaakov girl would ever go to college. In fact, I knew Rebbetzin Cutler. I knew her very well, because I worked at a place, if anyone from the New York area might remember the place, called Simcha by the Sea. It was a hotel, a catering hall. It was run by a Lakewood man, former Lakewood Rabbi Newhouse. And they would have bar mitzvahs and weddings. On Shabbos, you'd have bar mitzvahs, Shabbos brachos. And Revitzin Cutler, the old Revitzin Cutler, Avraham Cutler's widow and the daughter, Revitzin Schwartzbaum, who at the time was divorced, they would come every single Shabbos. And he, you know, that was where they came. And I was there. I used to carry their bags. I was her waiter. At the time, I didn't realize what a sophisticated woman this is. I don't even know if she's still alive. I never took the opportunity to talk to her, to hear stories. And there was many gedolim who used to come, and I would speak to them all. The Feinstein family came. I did their shalom brachos, everything. Let me tell you something interesting. There was no hashkacha on this hotel. And everyone came. When the Satmar used to come, they would bring their own mashkiach, but there was no hashkacha. I talked Torah with the Dov Schwartzman, with the Feinsteins. They all came. Everyone came, including Revitzin Schwartzman, but I never had the opportunity because I didn't know really to speak to her about these matters. I don't think we have a hotel today which doesn't have a shkacha and people would go. In making of a gadol, he does show himself to be a master of the Lithuanian yeshiva world, but there are many problems in the book. I know we'll hear from Professor Lyman a few of them, and I wouldn't even mention them if he didn't portray this as a real book of history. I mean, he calls himself Nathan. I don't think anyone in the world ever called him Nathan. He has a picture of himself on the back, you know, with the discussion of the author and all this. It looks like it's supposed to be a real historical book, and that's why you must call attention to shortcomings. First of all, his use of sources. He actually has hundreds of personal communications, oral history, interviews. Now, oral history can be valuable, but when you have documentary evidence, it must yield to it. And certainly in a book that expects to be taken seriously as a historical book, you can't tell a story about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said to the Rogachover in the privacy of their hotel room 100 years ago when no one else was in there. I mean, now this is nice in the yeshiva world, you tell these stories, but not as a real history. He wants his book to be judged by the standards of scholarship, and therefore in this respect is sorely lacking. After my review of his book appeared, you can all see this in more detail on the Eda website, Eda.org, Rabbi Kamenetsky wrote to me, he said, I've survived the banning, so I'll survive the panning. I praise him too, but another problematic aspect of the book is his use of unnamed sources. Now, you can do this in journalism, but not in scholarship, and especially one of the most controversial passages, which portrays Rav Aharon's cover's future father-in-law, Rishis Zalman Meltzer, asking the Altar of Sabaka about him, and the Altar of Sabaka saying something negative about Rav Aharon Cutler, that in the future we're all going to suffer because of his frumkeit. He says, you look down at the footnote, where does he get it from? An anonymous source. You know, if it's an anonymous source, if this is Rav Aharon's daughter, oh, that's important. And maybe that would make it reliable. But if it's as if he often does, X heard from Y, heard from Z about an event 100 years ago, then you can't really print it. And in terms of anonymous sources, in my book, this is a story. It's a loaded story. He must have known it. I mean, probably Rav Aharon was writing love letters to his fiancée. I had all sorts of stories about Rabbi Friedrich of Weinberg. Some of them, which I know are true, because the person told me, but he doesn't want to go on the record, so I couldn't print them. Others, which I don't know if they're true, because again, it's X heard from Y. But you can't put this in a real scholarly book. Now, as for the controversial elements of Making of a Gadol, which are only a tiny portion of the book, I'll leave it to others to judge whether they should have been included. One can easily understand in our day and age why the Haredi world leaders would react very sharply to any book that portrays Haredi Gadol even in a non-hagiographic light, that discusses conflicts between Gadolim one with the other, and even discusses personality flaws in various Gadolim. It's difficult for me to speak because my own work has been the subject of a major dispute in this regard, but I have therefore given this issue a good deal of thought. Every biography, and we heard this before, involves choosing from a mass of information in order to portray various characters. When dealing with potentially controversial matters, my yardstick has always been whether the information will help in one's assessment of the individual's concern, or if it's simply voyeuristic gossip. Now, Kamenetsky would reply, no doubt, that this is a judgment call, and he was not seeking to write an intellectual history, but in order to seeking to portray personalities. And indeed, they do come to life in his book, with stories, fascinating stories, tales. The question at the end of the day, of course, is, are they true? And I will say, just in closing with his book, that I do believe, I didn't write this in the review, and I didn't tell it to him. I had a number of long conversations with him. In fact, someone asked me, and they posted, I don't know, it's all over the web, my version, which comes right from him, of how the whole book was put under the ban. There was all sorts of rumors, and I called him up. He was in Muncie at the time, and I got the whole version. But the book is disrespectful, in my opinion, to Rav Aharon Cutler. There's no question about it. in that even by saying certain things in a truthful way, I'm assuming there is a dispute between his father and Rav Aharon. He does put it in a way that he didn't need to put it that way. He could have said the same point, and in my opinion, people could disagree about that. I think he could have said it and got the truth across without... leave it at that. Each one has to read the book and judge on their own. The response, in which basically he's declared the worst heretic since Yerubbaal ben Nevat, is certainly out of proportion to all what he's done. Okay, now to Jonathan Sachs's book, which is in a completely different category, and the reasons for the controversy are much more fundamental, indeed reaching to the very heart of what traditional Judaism affirms. The controversy actually forced Sachs to issue a new softcover edition in which all the disputed passages that I'm going to mention here have been removed. Now, what is made, although he has still stands by the first edition, he says, despite the fact that he is the second edition, I am not retracting anything in the first edition, and anyone who's spoken to him, I have students who've spoken to him, he only tells them, buy the first edition, don't buy the second edition. And they're both still in print. What has made the book, so if you go to Amazon and you order the softcover edition because it's maybe a little cheaper, you're not getting the original book. It's not just the two separate editions, but you don't know that because it says hardcover, softcover. What has made the book so controversial is that Sachs stakes out an ecumenical position that apparently breaks new theological ground, which understandably is anathema in Haredi circles. And what must be considered, and what shockingly Sachs does not do, is whether there is any support in the Jewish tradition for his approach. Before discussing the book, let me briefly describe his general position those aspects. The book is an attempt to provide guidance in an era of globalization so we can avoid the so-called clash of civilizations. In addition to religion, he focuses on charity, education, value, and problems of capitalism. Yet it's his theory of religion that's the most original. And Rebbe Yoshev, in a letter to the Rebbe of Gateshead, to characterize the book, quote, as containing heresy and matters that are against our faith in the Holy Torah, and it is forbidden to have such a book in one's home. According to Sachs, in the current post-September 11th climate, we must do more than simply have tolerance for other cultures and religions, and do more than search for common values and give other religions basic respect. Rather, we must celebrate the diverse world we live in. Such a celebration of diversity, Sachs claims, is more than tolerance and even more than pluralism. It is a recognition of the truth found in all religions. Now, 40 years ago, at the height of the ecumenical movement, a number of Jewish leaders were asked, Commentary Magazine had a symposium and asked a number of Jewish religious leaders, including many Orthodox leaders, the following question. Is Judaism the one true religion, or is it one of several true religions? And it is significant that none of the Orthodox respondents, and they include liberals such as Emanuel Rachman and others, none of the Orthodox respondents were willing to grant that there is any truth in other religions other than the truths which Mendelssohn would describe as the product of reason. So, for example, if Christianity teaches that murder is wrong, that's a truth, but that's a truth of reason. It's not a truth that's specific to Christianity. It's not a religious truth that Christianity teaches that, for example, that we don't have. It's not a truth particular to that faith, and that's not what Sachs has in mind. Sachs is a child of a different era, one in which postmodern ideas are now prevalent, and if you ever read Sachs, and he's enormously prolific, his favorite word, I think, is hermeneutic. It is very difficult often to get a handle on him because he writes in a lot of jargon, but he really is a child of the postmodern world, and this explains his alternative view of religion and indeed of truth. In fact, he attempts to locate, quote, the celebration of religious diversity at the very heart of the monotheistic imagination, and he begins his book by describing an interfaith service that took place at Ground Zero in New York City, at which the Archbishop of Canterbury, a Muslim imam, a Hindu guru, recited prayers and meditations, and the Chief Rabbi of Israel read a reflection. I guess that gets out of the violation of having an interfaith service if the Chief Rabbi of Israel reads the reflection, although he was there while they were praying. According to Sachs, this is a model of how religion should coexist. He sees our era in which, quote, the great faiths must now become an active force for peace and for the justice and compassion on which peace ultimately depends. This requires great courage, and perhaps something more than courage, a candid admission that, more than at any time in the past, we need to search, each faith in its own way, for a way of living with and acknowledging the integrity of those who are not of our faith. Can we make space for difference? Can we hear the voice of God in a language, a sensibility, a culture not our own? In other words, Sachs is asking us to see God not merely in the peoples of the world, but in their varying religions. This is a very bold stance when one considers Judaism's monotheistic tradition. And Sachs himself acknowledges, quote, "I have not hesitated to be radical, and I have deliberately chosen to express that radicalism in religious terms. As he puts it, our faith can, quote, give rise to a generosity of spirit, capable of recognizing the integrity, yes, even the sanctity, of worlds outside our faith." In pre-modern times, quote, "it was possible to believe that our truth was the only truth, our way the only way. Today the challenge is, can I, a Jew, hear the echo of God's voice in that of a Hindu or Sikh or Christian and Muslim? Can I do so and feel not diminished but enlarged? What then becomes of my faith, which until then had encompassed the world and must now make room for another faith, another way of interpreting the world?" Sachs' conclusion is to reject the notion that, quote, "one God entails one faith, one truth, one covenant." In other words, while God's covenant at Sinai remains true for the Jewish people, other religions are expressions of alternative covenants of God, each of which represent their own truth. Remember, he says it's not one truth, not one covenant. In Sachs' words, quote, "God has spoken to mankind in many languages, through Judaism to Jews, Christianity to Christians, Islam to Muslims. God is the God of all humanity. No single faith is or should be the faith of all humanity." Now, although he claims his position is not an endorsement of polytheism, he never explains why not. Sachs himself tells us that the truth on earth is not the entire truth. He says, when two propositions conflict, it is not necessarily because one is true and the other is false. It may be, and often is, that each represents a different perspective on reality, an alternative way of structuring order. In heaven there is truth, on earth there are truths. Typical postmodern formulation. Who then is to say that a polytheistic conception is not the truth of another culture? A different perspective on reality, to use his words, while monotheism is the truth of the Jews. After all, as Sachs notes, quote, "God is greater than religion. He is only partially comprehended by any faith." You can already sense, without me going further in quotes, what the Gadolin found problematic with this. I see no way to accept Sachs' basic proposition at the same time to discount the legitimacy of polytheism for those cultures who approach the divine in this fashion. Sachs himself says, with reference to religious truth, quote, "each culture has something to contribute." In other words, he explicitly includes even polytheistic societies. Once Sachs is prepared to understand truth in a non-absolutist sense, then it is not merely Christianity and Islam that become part of the great circle of truth, but all religious expression. Well, does the Jewish tradition have room for such a position, one that speaks of multiple religious truths? Since the outlook he describes is the product of new intellectual approaches, many will wonder how sages of previous generations could possibly offer support for this. Now, to be sure, new positions can be offered in Jewish theology, but unless there is some support in the tradition for this new position, both the individual advocating it and the position itself will probably be read out of the fold. Sachs himself acknowledges, as I mentioned, that his approach is radical, and he says, quote, "God is summoning us to a new act of listening, going back to the sources of our faith, and hearing in them something we missed before because we did not face these challenges. In religions of revelation, discoveries are always rediscoveries, a discovery of something that was always there, but not necessarily audible from where our ancestors stood." Clearly, we're faced with a controversial position when he admits that the view he's advocating was not, indeed could not have been known in previous generations. Since he posits that a basic religious truth was unknown to the greats of previous generations but has now been revealed to us, we can understand the reaction. If we are to conclude, as Sachs seems to, that while his position has biblical roots, it is absent from the rabbinic tradition, then we'd be forced to agree with the Haredi critique. In fact, he came out on his website with, after all the controversy, what he believes to be sources from the rabbinic tradition justifying it, and the sources are all a red herring. They all speak about truth, and that is that there's Chachma Begoyim, like you can learn science from the Gentiles. None of them come anywhere near to speak about religious truth. I will offer what I think to be the best possible defense of his position, and his book mentions nothing about the rabbinic tradition. He basically says that we have to go back to the sources of the Bible. Now, some might argue that there's lots of things we know today that previous generations do not know. We know things that the Chassam Sofer didn't know. Yet these are matters in the realm of history and science. Sachs is referring to a basic theological assumption. If he can show that we now recognize facts, that the last 2,000 years our rabbis do not recognize, facts which change our reality, and therefore we have to have a new approach, that would be important. Yet he doesn't do that. He simply asserts that there's a need to go back to the sources of our faith and hear something that wasn't heard in previous generations. Now, the assertion, as he makes, that previous generations lacked our multicultural perspective is simply begging the point. For he has not established that our multicultural perspective is positive in and of itself and can be used as a new springboard for a new ecumenical ideology. What he acknowledges is, quote, a paradigm shift in our understanding of our commonalities and differences. Any efforts in this direction must proceed on the basis of Jewish sources rather than on the ex cathedra postmodern declarations. So let's briefly take up the question of whether there is any basis in traditional Jewish sources for Sachs's assertion that there is truth, indeed sanctity, in other religions. Nowhere does Sachs discuss the issue of Avodah Zarah, which I think is crucial, because it stands as a contradiction to his claim that the truth of Judaism need not mean the falsehood of other religions. If the other religions fall into the category of Avodah Zarah, how can we not affirm their falsehood? And at first glance, there appears to be no room for speaking of such religions as wonderful ingredients in God's great mosaic. And rather than honoring these religions for what they offer their adherents, as Sachs wants us to do, it would seem that Halacha wants us to condemn these religions for adopting a non-monotheistic theology. Needless to say, this is hardly the friendly perspective that Sachs wants Judaism to offer, especially to winnow down at ground zero, having a joint prayer service. Yet this assumption that religions of Avodah Zarah are deserving of condemnation, while seemingly the Talmudic approach, and codified by Maimonides, and this is what you get it, and you go to yeshiva, is not the only perspective our tradition offers. An opening for a more tolerant approach is seen in the writings of the Meiri. Now, the Meiri is often cited as arguing that Christianity is not a form of idolatry, and therefore you don't have to relate to them like the pagans of old. But he can actually be read as saying a lot more than that. If you take all of his statements and put them together, as has been done recently by Moshe Halbertal, you see that the Meiri essentially regards idolatry as a moral error, not a theological error. To put it another way, the main problem with Gentile idolatry is that it leads to a society not bound by any civilized behavior, in which people are killed for no reason, things of that nature. Today it is obvious that we can indeed speak of societies which are, quote, restricted by the ways of religion, that's the Meiri's term, that is civilized, even if these societies or religions are, from a strict theological standpoint, idolatrous. In fact, in one place, the Meiri actually says that he refers to nations restricted by the ways of religion as, quote, worshiping the divinity in any way, even if it's far from our own. It is certainly possible to construct an interpretation of Meiri's approach to idolatry that would enable religious acceptance even of the archetypal pagan of the Orient, which is often mentioned. The second page of Sarim published in Eastern Europe, they say all the negative things about idolaters. They don't refer to the Christians. They only refer to those people off in India and China. This interpretation would be especially valuable in modern days because we now live with polytheists, and you can see they're not evil people. I had a rabbi who told me, one of his congregants came back from India. He said, they're wonderful people. They're not anti-Semitic. You know, we're supposed to regard these people as idolaters. You know, they're not the evil ones. The evil ones are in France, you know. This might have been the interpretation in the mind of Rabbi Chilak of Weinberg, who writes, who first of all was particularly adamant that we must accept the Meiri's view so, quote, we could put an end to the hatred of the religions one for the other. Elsewhere, he writes quite ecumenically, quote, we believe that a Gentile can also be blessed when he remains true to his religion and faithfully fulfills its precepts. He doesn't say if he observes the Shabbat Mitzvah B'nai Noach. He says if he remains true to his religion and faithfully observes its precepts, presumably good precepts. The common assumption is that Meiri's view has no source in rabbinic literature. Yet there is one midrash, I found, which actually expresses a remarkable tolerance of idolatry. Shmos Rabbah 15:23 reads as follows, quote, it is written, let them be only thine own, and not strangers with thee. The Holy One, blessed be he, said, I do not warn idolaters concerning idolatry, but you. And then it goes on. It's hard to find a more clear declaration that idolatry is only a prohibition as far as Jews are concerned. Let me call attention also to Deuteronomy 4:19, which states, and lest thou lift up thine eyes into heaven, and when thou seest the sun and the moon and the stars, even all the host of heaven, thou be drawn away and worship them and serve them, which the Lord thy God has allocated unto all the peoples under the heaven. The implication appears clear, and was noted as such by Rashbam, that the stars in the heavens They're intended for the nations to worship. Not for you, but it's okay if they do it. They're supposed to do it. That's how they can relate to God. Malachi 1:11 states, "For from the rising of the sun, even unto the going down of the same, my name is great among the nations, and in every place offerings are presented unto my name, even pure libations, for my name is great unto the nations, says the Lord of hosts." This verse seemingly recognizes the religious legitimacy of non-Israelite worship, which was idolatrous. In other words, although the adherents of other faiths offer sacrifices to other gods, God regards this worship as in some way being directed towards Him as well, even though He per se is not yet recognized. Now this notion that Gentiles are not bound by a prohibition on idolatry, although apparently very strange from what we've been taught to believe, is also affirmed by two important commentators, Rav Yitzchak Abravanel and Rav Yitzchak Aramba, the Akeas Yitzchak. These are major medieval commentators. In fact, the Abravanel cites this verse in Deuteronomy, which I just cited, and he concludes from it that the Ninevites were not punished for their idolatry. They were going to be punished for other things. But idolatry, they're supposed to worship idolatry. The Akeas Yitzchak even cites a text in Bava Kamma where Rav Yosef says that God measured the earth and beheld the nations, and that, what did He do? He saw that they weren't observing the Shabbat of B'nai Noach, so therefore he granted them an exemption. Now it's true that later in Amorim they change, they say, no, they didn't really, don't take this literally, but the Akeas Yitzchak sits to the first interpretation that the Shabbat of B'nai Noach are no longer binding on Gentiles. Not noted by the Akeas Yitzchak is that Vayikra Rabbah is also explicit, that, quote, Gentiles were unable to endure even the seven precepts, therefore God took these off and put them on Israel. And we don't have time today to go into it, then what does it mean? If a society that doesn't have the Shev Mitzvah Svein Noach, in brief, what it means is that law will be based on convention, not on revelation. How to make this work together with, I had a correspondence with Dr. Berger on this, together with all the prophets that speak about the ethical obligations. That's the topic we can talk later for another time. I can't really go into it now, and I didn't go into it much in my article, although it's possible to construct an interpretation that it's really when they're living with Jews that it's a problem, but if you have some idolaters living on an island in the middle of nowhere, that's not a condemnable offense. So we can go into that perhaps later, but let me just say, and this view was even found in later authorities. One of the Tosafists holds this view and says that before Matan Torah, they were obligated to show Mitzvah Svein Noach, after they weren't. The Maharit says this, Rishon Al-Ghazi, the Ramami Panu, Rav Yitzchak Palachi, a number of sages say this. Hirsch implies it. Now, these are minority views, don't get me wrong here. But minority views have a place in the tradition, especially so if we're dealing with a matter of theology which really doesn't require us to make a practical ethical decision. And since Sachs is seeking to develop a radical idea, it's crucial that he have at least some support in the tradition that will permit him to extend honor and even speak about these other religions as being valid for the other adherents. The sources I cite here and in my article, I think, are the best you can get that, at least to provide an opening, a recognition that perhaps the approach we've had for so long, maybe there's room to develop another approach. It's not for me. I'm not a theologian. I need that for the theologians. But, I mean, these are some of the sources which could be of assistance. So far, I've only spoken of the negative. And in the few minutes I have left, let me speak a little bit of the positive. When I say the negative, the notion that I've shown sources that say that perhaps Gentile idolatry is not prohibited. But what about what else Sachs says? That other religions have real objective truth. Can we find support for this in the tradition? Here, too, there were some passages that could have assisted Sachs, which he didn't cite. Perhaps he didn't know. Well, at least this first one he certainly knows. The most famous is found at the end of the Mishnah Torah, when Maimonides notes that both Christianity, which according to the Rambam is idolatrous, pure and simple, and Islam serve to clear the way for the Mashiach to prepare the whole world to worship God with one accord. In other words, while both of these religions, Christianity and Islam, contain truth, religious truth, and they serve to move society closer to a true view of God, a pure view of God. Now, to be sure, the Rambam sees its truth as provisional. It's just a stage. To get them out of idolatry, Christianity brings them closer to monotheism. But it's still significant, I think, in that it recognizes that other religions, even idolatrous ones, which Christianity is for the Rambam, can indeed contain truth. And what about his more extreme assertion that other religions also contain sanctity, kedusha? I grant you, when I saw that immediately struck me. I said, it's impossible. The other ones I was able to find sources for about another religion contained Kedusha. When I looked a little further, I was happy to find that even that, perhaps. The Talmud speaks of prophets. This is in Bav Basra, Tesvav Amud Beis. The Talmud speaks of prophets who were sent to the nations of the world. Their role was to bring God's word. And it is certainly possible that this word could exist in the framework of another religion. Furthermore, one need not assume that the prophets, the Talmud mentions Gentile prophets, there's no reason to assume that these are the only prophets that have appeared. Although there are rabbinic passages that state that once the Torah was given, Ruach HaKodesh was removed from the Gentiles, this is not a unanimous view. In fact, the Rambam rejects this. And the clearest support for Sachs' position is a Yemenite sage, Rav Nisanel ben Alfayumi. He wrote an important work, Rav Kafach translated it and published it. He maintains that God claimed that God's truth was not encompassed by Judaism. According to Rav Nisanel, various religions are to be viewed by their adherents, and correctly so, as sanctified. Now, I do not intend to argue that Sachs' position is reflective of the main trend in rabbinic thought, and certainly is not. However, it is also the case that some precedent can be found even for his most radical statements. There is no question that he has gone beyond these earlier sources and offered a more complete theory of ecumenism than could possibly have been offered in previous generations. And one can certainly disagree with him, and I'm not comfortable with much of what he writes, in particular his obvious enthrallment with multiculturalism, which he sees as the solution, but me, sitting in America, I see as part of the problem. Yet by the same token, Haredi assertions that the chief rabbi's comments are a denial of a foundational Jewish belief, heresy pure and simple of the sort that must be uprooted from its core, also strike me as wide of the mark. And from the Haredi perspective, his apology has not helped. They still regard him as an apostate. As I just was told by someone from England who came here, they might relate to him publicly, but he's regarded as an apostate. That, I think, is really going overboard, and that although one can disagree and say these are not mainstream, you have the Abarbanel, you have the Akedah, you have the other sources. I think, again, we see another example where perhaps going over the top, and I don't have time to go into it, there's also political issues involved here. The Haredim want to destroy the English chief rabbin, or if they can't, they want to put their own people in to run it. So there's politics involved as well. But it was framed, very interestingly, as a theological debate between a liberal chief rabbi and a medieval reactionary Haredi rabbinate, and probably the truth is somewhere in the middle. Thank you very much.